Now, what's the most efficient way to store data? You might think that it's on a microchip or on some kind of laser disc, but the answer is actually lying inside your own cells. DNA may actually be the best option for archiving data. Dr. Nick Goldman from the European Bioinformatics Institute in Hinxton has developed a method for storing computer files in DNA format. Hello, Nick.
Hello.
So, first of all, just to sort of clarify, how does a computer store data?
So a computer, it shows you a picture or it plays you an audio file, but actually what it's storing is zeros and ones on a hard disk or in its memory, and it's also storing information about the code that's needed to convert the zeros and ones back to whatever it is.
So when we say binary, it is literally naught or one, and it knows the code for what a sequence of noughts and ones mean.
That's
and
right.
How that translates into something on the screen or whatever you choose to do.
That's right. And of course, there's a different code for if that's a document in a word processor or a PDF file or an MP3 or whatever.
And when you save that onto your hard disk, you're effectively putting that pattern of noughts and ones on your hard disk or a series of little pits on the surface of a CD player.
That's right. Pits on a CD disk that will go in a player or magnetization on the platters of a hard disk drive.
So why did you decide, well, okay, we're going to do it with DNA instead?
We were inspired to do it because of the difficulties we have at the European Bioinformatics Institute, where we're responsible for storing vast amounts of biological data and serving that over the internet to the whole world of molecular biologists.
So you mean DNA sequences and things that people upload to your database?
It's not only DNA sequences, but that certainly is some of the largest amounts of information.
Well, how much information are you storing then?
We are storing and serving to the world 3 petabytes of information at the EBI at the moment.
Gosh, that is quite a That's a lot of hard disks, isn't it?
It's a lot of hard disks.
So that you said, look, this is such a huge number of hard disks. Is there another way?
That's right. We're running out of money to store all the information that's being sent to us these days. And so over the years, we've had a number of discussions about whether there were any alternatives. And we've had a number of very serious discussions about alternatives. But one evening in the pub in Hamburg, we had a rather frivolous one and noted that DNA itself, as it happens, is also a very good way of storing information.
Yeah, indeed, because I mean, otherwise nature probably wouldn't have, over millions of years, arrived at using DNA as a good choice.
It's a bit chicken and egg how you have this discussion, but because DNA is good, so we're discussing DNA. So yeah, that's right.
So how did you then say, well, look, can we use DNA instead of a computer hard disk?
Well, we said exactly that, and then we bought another beer and got some more napkins to write on and started working out if we could actually do it in some sense. And by the end of the evening, we'd worked out that we could do it because the technologies that are now being developed for genome science allow us to read DNA sequences. They're getting better at allowing us to write DNA sequences, which is really useful for certain particular experiments you want to do. And if you sort of stick all these technologies together, you sort of glue it together by courier services and so on, and emails to each other, then we could do the whole thing. We could start with a hard disk drive, go via actual physical DNA and back to something on a hard disk drive that hopefully would be the same as we started with.
Well, DNA's got 4 genetic letters, A, C, T and G.
Yeah.
A hard disk has noughts and ones.
Yeah.
So how did you get around that?
Well, it's very easy to do the coding at a naive level. If you take 2 noughts and ones next to each other, then there's 4 different ways you could get something. You could get a nought and a nought, a nought and a one. I'll go through them all for you, folks. A one and a nought, and a 1 and a 1. So there's 4 choices there. So you could just assign to each pair of zeros and ones one of the letters A, C, G or T. And that might work, but we wanted to do something that was a little cleverer. But in particular, we were thinking in the longer term, if this was ever really going to be useful, we'd want to add in some real life stuff like error correction into the codes. And that meant we had to sacrifice a bit of the efficiency of coding, but we can build in various techniques in the code that will mean if we eventually are reading back a bit down the line here, we read back some of the DNA. If something has gone a little bit wrong, maybe we can recover from that error and not lose any of the original information.
So you take the sequence of noughts and ones that the computer's got. You then translate that into a sequence of DNA where the genetic letters mean either a nought or a one or a one or a nought or the combinations you said. You then make artificially the
right
DNA sequence.
There's one little part in the story there you skipped over. Humans can't yet make very long strings of DNA. We can make fairly short ones, up to, say, well, nowadays up to about 200 nucleotides, 200 letters long. So we knew we'd need some system that would take the very long message that's in one computer file and break it into little pieces. So still in the computer, we wrote a series of letters A, C, G and T, and then we cut it up into pieces of 100 letters each. And then we added some more information to each one of those little segments that would tell us where it came from, which file it belonged to.
The address, if you like.
Exactly, indexing and where in that file it belongs. So we end up with these slightly larger designs, you might call them, about 120 letters of DNA. And then we wrote that onto a computer file. We sent it over the internet to our collaborators in California. And they're the people that have the technology that actually makes this stuff. And they can make pieces that length.
And you translated a whole lot of data into DNA.
Yep.
And then how do you get the DNA data back out again?
Back out again. So they put it through their machine in California, which is sort of like a kind of inkjet printer or an equivalent of an inkjet printer. And then it comes in a little test tube. It's a tiny speck of dust in the test tube. And they put that in a cardboard box and they send it by FedEx. We'll probably optimize the procedure in the future, but at the moment, that's how it's done.
And then you dissolve that, put it in the machine, and say, read this the same way we read the human genome.
Exactly. And we designed the whole system so it would use exactly the same procedures that my laboratory colleagues are very familiar with. So instead of starting with DNA from a human genome or another genome you're studying, we started with dry DNA in a test tube, but we designed that. We did some extra features in the design so that would then go straight into the standard laboratory procedures for reading it back on another piece of advanced technology, which every self-respecting bio lab will have nowadays.
How is this actually going to get applied? Because are we working towards a sort of DNA computer where, you know, you won't have a hard disk, but you're going to have a sort of reactor pool on your desktop where you're making DNA molecules?
We're not thinking of working in that direction at the moment. One of the problems is it's still very expensive, and another one is it's not very fast. But the good thing about DNA is it's really, really long-lived. So we've already heard this evening about getting DNA from wolves and things and thinking about that. But if you look at other creatures, we routinely now can sequence DNA from Neanderthals or cave bears, you know, 10,000 years old or more. So it's really stable. So all these things together suggested to us the thing to go for is something that you want to keep a very long time. So DNA will sit there. You don't have to do anything to look after it. If you keep it cool and dry and in the dark, it's good for tens of thousands of years. And the experiment's essentially been done. For example, you know, a woolly mammoth 50,000 years ago crawls out onto the tundra and dies. And then 50,000 years later, we can get DNA back from it. So we're looking at things that you'd want to store a really long time and you don't mind spending quite a lot of money on. So we're thinking, you know, global important archives of, you know, the Doomsday Book, or maybe, you know, US presidential archives, or records about where all the nuclear waste dumps are. Things that you don't mind paying, admittedly, quite a lot. But you really want to know that information is safe somewhere.
I was thinking of whiskey myself. Nick Goldman from the European Bioinformatics Institute, thank you very much. He published that work this week in the journal Nature. Now, you're listening to The Naked Scientist with me, Chris Smith, and also with Ben Vowsler. If you'd like to get in touch with any questions or comments, you can email us. It's chris@thenakedscientist.com. You can also tweet @nakedscientists, or you can find us on Facebook.
Now,